tell me a little bit about your background. How long have you been in Alaska, and what brought you here, and what do you do?
Well, what brought me here was I was working for an oil field service company. I came here initially in 1987. I was working for a company called Sperry Sun Drilling Services, and what I did was provide a service where we logged wells while we drilled instead of the traditional way of coming in afterwards and doing a wireline log. So I came up for that. And
What does that mean, logging wells while you drill?
Oh, measuring different parameters of the formations. So what I was doing was measuring resistivity, conductivity, porosity, and permeability, and gamma ray radiation. So for that, gamma ray radiation just tells you how shaley things are. Porosity and permeability are kind of interlocked with one another. You want to be able to have pore space, and you want to have the connectivity so you can have fluids that can move. So these pieces aren't really trapped in little spots, and they're just stranded. Huh. And so when you're logging while you drill, one of the best things about it is you can see the drilling fluid move into the formation. That'll tell you that's really a confirmation of the permeability of a formation. And then you can go back in over time, and you can see how much more has gone in.
And so that brought you here. What kept you here is always the better question to ask.
That is the better question. I met my wife up here. We met at, this is funny. We met at the Miners and Trappers Ball. That's a big costume ball in Anchorage. And by the time it was all said and done, she and I were both working on our private pilot's license at the same time. She was flying out of another fixed-based operator at Merrill Field from the one that I was in. And we just started having a good conversation. It was the first really good conversation I'd had in a while. So we started seeing each other, and then the rest, well, you know, developed into a relationship.
And so that's what rooted you in Alaska.
That, and, you know, I can't think of any other place I'd want to live. I've lived in a lot of places. I've worked around the world. This was all by the time I was 26. Now that's 26 years ago. I'm 52 now. So it was one of those things where, like, I'd worked in Norway before I came to Alaska, and I said to myself, you know, if I ever have a chance to move to Norway and live here because I'm a geologist, you know, it's like this would be like heaven, absolute nirvana. And then I had a chance to come up and work in Alaska, open up a district up here, and I was like, well, I wish I'd seen this place first. This is where I'm going to live. This is my own country, so it's great.
Where did you grow up? Where was home before Alaska?
I was born in Louisiana. Lived there for 15 years or so, and then my father took a transfer down to Houston, Texas, graduated from high school down there. So I would say the South.
Yeah.
My son says it's the Deep South, but I point out to him where I was born in Shreveport, we were considered Yankees. So he doesn't get it, but that's the way it is.
What made you decide to run for Congress?
Well, it had something to do with me and my wife having kids. Our children now are 15 and 17. And I looked at the job that our current congressman's doing for us, and I thought, you know, we could do a lot better than that. We have too many times when we have just one congressman that's present representing the entire state of Alaska, and he doesn't show up. He's not present for votes. I look at what his record is, and I look at his committee assignments. I think committee assignments are very important. And he doesn't chair any committees except for the subcommittee on Indian Affairs. Since he has about 40 years of experience in Congress, he should be chairing almost every one of those committees unless someone says, we have a new person that's coming in, they need to get more experience. So I look and see that there's someone that's been in Congress for maybe 3 or 4 years chairing a committee, and we have someone with almost 40 years experience that's not. And it makes me question, it's like, what is he doing? What has he done that's put him in that position where he's fallen out of favor?
I don't like to get too hung up on electoral math because, everybody gets one vote, and that's important. But
that's a pretty good deal.
But I have to ask you about the odds of beating Don Young in the fall.
Well, I will tell you, it's pretty funny. I had a friend of mine that told me a story. He said, here are these two opportunities that would have to take place for you to be able to beat him, and neither one of them seemed like they were very viable. And so for me, there are two things. One, it gives people a choice. And second, if people have gotten to the point where they're tired of this sort of representation, or in this case, maybe misrepresentation, there's another option that's out there for them. You aren't going to have to choose between the lesser of two evils. You can find someone that's articulate, intelligent, someone that's actually rooted to the state, and someone that plans on being here for the rest of their life, which is me, to represent them. That's, I would say, yeah, that's pretty good. My odds of beating him? Oh, we'll have to see. If I make it through the primary, And if he'll show up and we can go on and start debating, I think everyone will see the difference. And I think the table will turn very quickly.
So a crowded field, one of whom has legislative experience.
Right.
What sets you apart?
Oh, it's real simple. I don't go and tell people what to do. I go to different places and listen to folks. I'm the only one that's been campaigning across the state during the primary. I'm the only one that's really trying to make a go of it. And for me, I'm sitting there saying, you know, this is an opportunity really to represent Alaska. You should try your best, not just say, I'm going to do it.
Where have you been? What have you heard?
Well, I went down to Ketchikan. I went to Metlakatla. It turns out I was the only person that's been there since Wally Hickel visited in the 60s. So for politicians, I don't know if that's the kiss of death or raving endorsement. Been up to Fairbanks, been up to the Valley a few times, down to Soldotna, Kenai a few times as well. So what I've heard from a lot of people is real similar, but not exactly the same. So what I hear is that, like in Fairbanks, they're really concerned about energy prices. The cold winter that they had this last winter was almost more than most of them could bear. They spent all of their spare money. They don't have any discretionary funds now. So they're really concerned that if they have another winter like they had with the way that the heating fuel bills go, that they would be pretty much broke or forced to move. People that have rental properties, they're at the point where they're not making money. And the people that would normally be in them are moving out as well. So that was one thing I heard. Ketchikan, they want to be able to have more electricity. They don't right now. They're at their max, and the shipyard is building up, and the repair yard is. And so they would like to be able to have more electricity available. Metlakatla has the possibility of having a hydro plant, and they would love to be able to tie in with everybody and sell their electricity back. So there are a lot of pieces that are really out there that are good, that are isolated, that could help one another, but they haven't figured out how to integrate yet. So that's one of the things that they really need to work on. So down in Soldotna, one of the things that they're concerned about with down there is really a problem, which was the return of the Kings and them keeping their nets out, their set nets out. You know, one of the things that we really need to look at is what's the real problem? You know, are we having problems with trawlers intercepting too much bycatch? Or are we having foreign fleets that are pirating our fish away? It's got to be one of the two, or maybe a combination of both. But, you know, we need to get down to the bottom of that very quickly, because the folks that are on the Yukon that normally have a chance to catch fish, can fish, or smoke fish and use those throughout the winter, they're not getting that opportunity.
Let's talk about energy development for just a second. Here in Southeast, the big energy source is hydro.
Right.
And one of the impediments that we hear here in Sitka is that Alpine Hydro is not recognized by the federal government as a renewable resource because of, and again, this is the picture that's painted from this end, but the argument is that the federal government looks at what happened on the Columbia River and looks at what happened in, you know, places down south.
Sure.
That have impacted fish and impacted wildlife. And so they've deemed hydro, you know, not a renewable sustainable.
It's not a real option for you because of what it will do.
Right. And so it's hard to get federal funding here for hydro projects because it's not on that magic list of renewable, clean, non-impactful resources as Alpine Hydro seems to be. So, you know, if elected to Congress, can you, what, you know, is that one of the things you would take a look at, or is that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, hydro costs a ton up front as far as projects. But when you look at the life of a project after it's completed, how long it can deliver electricity, you don't even have to go very far to look. You can look at Hoover Dam, see how long it's been in place, what it's doing. We're talking about some really cheap kilowatts being able to be generated from that. But you have to amortize the price of that project out over a long period of time to make it work. Is that something I would support? You bet I would. The big question is can you do it in a responsible way where you can still have fish return to the rivers and not have runs of salmon being impacted? And I think you can do it.
Right now, working its way through Congress, both the House version and the Senate version, legislation that would convey lands to the Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation. It's been kind of contentious down here.
I wonder why. I had actually seen a portion of that on YouTube from a committee hearing that Don Young was on. And so you can correct me at any point in time, but my understanding of it was that Sea Alaska wanted to trade about 240,000 acres for 80,000 acres of land. They said that it had cultural significance for them.
The overarching, the nutshell is that they, you know, ANCSA set up boxes that they could select land from.
Right.
And they want to select outside the box because some of the sites that were in the box no longer have value, or A couple of them are mountaintops. Some of them are now underwater. Mm-hmm. So they've asked to move around a little bit on some of those. And many of the sites that they have proposed for selection are important to the tourism industry, or people are concerned that they'll be logged or developed in some way.
Right.
So there's a battle there. And what's interesting is in Congress, Senator Murkowski's legislation has undergone a bunch of revisions based on hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Congressman Young's legislation has not. He's
right.
kind of stuck to his guns on it. What do you think about the legislation, the importance of the legislation going through, and also the fluidity of it?
Well, the democratic process is never something that you want to look at too closely. It's kind of like sausage being made. It's okay to eat sausage, but you might not want to after you've seen it made. In this particular case, yes, there should be some compromises that are made. They should have an opportunity to go out and look at other parcels. The big question is it just a trade of land for land that's been used up, such as logged, for land that potentially could have a logging value to it? If it's nothing more than that, that's going to be a real problem. That's going to be a hard pill, I think, for everyone in the Southeast to swallow. If it was something more than that, I think people could look at it a little bit differently and be a little bit more supportive of it.
Education. On your website, it says get parents and kids more involved in education from the get-go.
Sure. Surprisingly, I have an education. I use it occasionally.
What do you mean by getting them more involved from earlier in their education?
Well, for a lot of parents, it seems like what they do is they take their kids, they buy them clothes, get them some school supplies, and push them off to the closest school. Really what they need to do is they need to see them as themselves as being more of a part of the process, being able to help the kids when they get home, have time for them if they can, to be able to read to them, teach them how to read, teach them the basics. You know, that's what school's for, but when the parents are reinforcing it and saying that's a good thing, it lets the kids learn quicker. It's one of those things like when you have kids, you know, you get your children to do, when they do good things, you actually reward them. When they do bad things, hopefully you'll give them a deterrent so they can say, that's something, a behavior I don't want to do again. And so when you help the children learn faster, learn a little bit better, and make it a positive experience for them, it's something that they can take with them for their whole life.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, what role does the federal government play in better attuning kids to their education earlier, or making sure parents have that conduit into the education earlier?
Sure. Well, I think, there are early child programs that are available, and I think most parents should take advantage of those. As when I look at our educational system, I compare it on a global basis. We are global now, whether we like it or not. So when you look at other countries, especially like Asian countries and European countries, you'll see that they outscore us in a lot of areas. They have kids that are going to school all the time. Now, I'm not an advocate for sending a kid to school 24/7, but it's one of those things where when it comes to things like science and math, we're really going to have to pick up our game. And I think that one of the things that we can do from a federal perspective is encourage students and encourage schools to do a better job in those areas.
Looking at the scores and wondering about comparative ranks nation to nation is interesting. But you also say that you're not an advocate of teaching to the test. You're worried about that.
Oh, I am. Teaching to a test, if there was a job that was all about that test when they got out, great. But there's not. So, and one of the things we also do, too, is I think that when we look at the educational system that we have in our country, we've geared it so there'll be a child that will start in kindergarten or early kindergarten, first grade through 12th grade, and then on to college. Well, not every kid is going to go to college, and not everyone wants to go to college. And we don't really have a good defined path for those people to be able to say, these are the skill sets I have, these are the things I really want to do, and maybe give them one or two options along the way. So if there's an occupation they've chosen that they don't like, there's another choice for them. It seems like we've always geared everything for going to college. It's the goal that we have for all our kids. And I think it's part of the dream that we've had for a long time, that we always want our kids to have better than what we had.
You, as we mentioned earlier, you're a former slope worker. You're advocating opening ANWR on your website, and you say that you'll work to convince Democratic lawmakers who voted against it to change their minds.
Right.
How?
Well, that's a tough one. The way to do that really is to start forming relationships with other politicians in Washington as quickly as possible, find the ones that are really absolutely 100% against it, talk with them about it, and actually bring them up here and show them what we're talking about. and really what the benefit is for our state. Because when I look at it on a nationwide basis, you know, we could actually get cars that have better gas mileage, put those in place, have people start riding bicycles once or twice a month, and we could actually offset what we'd be able to produce in Anwar very easily. But right now we can't. We don't seem to have the political will in our country to do that. And for our state, it's one of the things that is good for our state because from a business perspective, we'd be able to have more money that's in the state, more jobs. So that's your trade-off, and you have to decide, how do you want the state to look when you're done with all of these different projects, and what are the things that are most important for you? And as a geologist, it may surprise you that I still want to have parts of this world, parts of the state, where they're untouched, absolutely untouched. And it's one of those things where you walk through the woods and you say, you know, I feel like I'm the first person that's ever been here. You want to have that feeling. And as I've told people before, Alaska is so diverse, you know, it's extremely hard to describe. If I said, well, here's what Southeast is, and try to explain it to somebody up in Barrow, they wouldn't know what I'm talking about. But at the same time, as hard as it is to describe, it's a real easy state to fall in love with. And those qualities that we have, it's like, yeah, I want to preserve those.
Gas pipeline. The gas pipeline has been discussed for years and years and years. How is that thing finally going to happen?
You know, I think what it's going to take is something like Fairbanks screaming more and more and saying, you know, we aren't going to be able to make it unless we do something like this. That's one option. The other one is to be able to start exploring in other places besides the North Slope for gas. So. And then there's the third, which is Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet has some pretty tough geology in it. Majority of the time when people go and drill in the Cook Inlet, they go there for oil. There's gas that's available. There's gas in the West Forelands. It's just a matter of getting the right folks in there to do the job. And so it could be that there will be a time where we have more gas than we need in the Anchorage area, more gas than we need in Cook Inlet, more gas than we need down the Kenai. And we really need to decide what to do with it. And if it's something that will help out Fairbanks, then yes, we should be looking at putting a gas line going south to north instead to help them out. That's, to me, that one's just a no-brainer.
Let's talk about healthcare.
Sure. Well, that's the other side of my life, huh?
Is it?
Yeah. Actually, I started managing medical practices back in 92.
Is that what you're doing now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I do that, and I also have a business called Medical Practice Solutions, and I teach physicians how to run their practices more efficiently, teach their staff as well, and also work on the customer satisfaction and service end of it as well.
Congress has voted, the House has voted dozens of times on repealing the Affordable Care Act. Where do you stand on the Affordable Care Act?
Well, why don't we see it work before we declare it dead on arrival? That's where I stand on it. I mean, there are a lot of good things that come out of it. There are a lot of people right now that, you know, that was, you had asked before, what am I hearing from people when I talk to them? One of them is healthcare. Healthcare is just an absolute killer for them. They're afraid that it's something that if they start looking at problems that they have, they're really concerned that it might bankrupt them once they get into it. And that's not the way it was supposed to be ever.
So you would vote no to repeal?
I would vote no to repeal at this point, yeah. In fact, that's one of the things that kind of gets me. It's like, here we are. We've got the baby in the bathwater. We haven't even seen the baby yet, and we're talking about throwing out the whole thing. It's like, how about we see if it works? Because, honestly, if I look at Congress and I see how gridlocked they are and how gridlocked they have been, the fact that they can't do anything other than just, you know, kind of yammer at one another, the fact that we've got automatic cuts are going to come up in January— and we've got all these jokers that are down there in Washington that are basically playing their fiddles while the country burns. I don't get it. It's just political grandstanding in my mind.
There are a couple of social issues on your website that you mention, and I want to ask you about one that you don't. But first, the one that you do.
that was slick.
The one that you do, though, is women's rights. You talk about pay equity. You talk about pro-choice. Mm-hmm. Why are those in particular important to you that you put them on your website?
They're important to me because those are the two biggest impediments that we have right now for women having true equality in this country. I mean, they have the right to vote. We see women that are in workplaces that traditionally aren't female work positions. And that's one of those things where over time it'll change. But in our state, what I found is if you come here and you have the capacity to do a job, no matter what your age, race, religious background, you'll get the job. And then if you prove that you can do it and you can do more, you'll probably get a promotion. But for women to think that they start off and they're making 75 cents on the dollar compared to us, that's just plain old wrong. For me, I've always thought everything was fair. And as soon as I found out that it wasn't, I remembered when I'm bringing my kids up, I'm going to tell them that things really aren't fair. You're going to think they are, but they may not be. And so this is one of those social inequalities that needs to actually be addressed. The other one is pro-choice. It's a woman's choice, what she does with her body. I would hate for someone to tell me, it's like, hey, Mr. Moore, guess what? You're eating too much, and we're going to take that last piece of sandwich away from you. It's like, we're going to have a fight. But for them, you know, and I kind of make light of it there, but for them to have someone tell them, this is the type of birth control you can or cannot have. This is what you can have access to as far as your decisions, as far as your health, and we'll legislate those for you. That's not what the government's about. The government should never be about telling you who you can marry, how you're going to decide how your family is going to be raised, how you're going to educate them, what your religious perspective is or what your preferences are. That's your personal freedom that you have. If someone takes it away from you, well, then it wasn't a freedom to start with, now was it?
So that segues nicely into the next question, which is one of the big social issues of our time is same-sex marriage,
right.
Gay rights in general beyond marriage.
Right.
Just thoughts on that.
Real simple. Again, it's one of those things that the government should have no say over whatsoever.
Well, but the government does have a say in recognizing marriage.
They do. And so, you know, maybe the baby step to take is to do a civil union, you know, to start with, and then get to the point where people can get comfortable with that and see that, you know, gay people are no different than heterosexual people, and get them to the point where there was no real difference at all. That's what it's really going to take.
So, ideally, just to make sure I'm clear, ideally, you would, if you could change the world tomorrow, where would you put it? You're talking about taking incremental steps toward a change.
Right.
Where's the end game for you?
The end game for me is everybody has the same rights. How hard is that?
All right. Well, Matt Moore, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.